From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a large meditation hall in central Massachusetts. This is the story told by longtime journalist Andrew Sullivan, who created perhaps the single most well-read blog on the internet and then abruptly quit 2 years ago. We haven't seen much of Sullivan since, but here he is in the pages of New York Magazine in September with a piece titled, I Used to Be a Human Being. Here's the subhead, which tells you exactly what's coming next. Quote, an endless bombardment of news and gossip and images has rendered us manic information addicts. It broke me. It might break you, too. End quote. So there was Andrew Sullivan sitting in that meditation hall when a woman in the front of the room held out a basket. And then, like parishioners putting cash into the Sunday collection, Sullivan swallowed hard and joined his fellow travelers in giving up their cell phones. He had considered himself addicted. He felt a personal crash was coming to his life. It was inevitable, so he was going to make this leap. How did it turn out? Well, I invite you to read the full piece, which I've posted on my Twitter feed. And here's why I'm talking about Sullivan's addiction. This hour, we want to explore something known as nature deficit disorder. It's related in many ways to our reliance on technology, and it goes beyond just taking a walk more often. It seeps sometimes into our schools, where some researchers believe kids are growing up without vital skills of just learning how to play independently and creatively outside. So let's have a conversation about nature deficit disorder, whether it's a real thing and what to do about it if it is. My guests include Lindsay Cray, who's the executive director of Earthworks Institute. Lindsay, it's great to have you back here. And let me just ask you before I introduce the rest of the guests, because you're the one who sent me this note saying, check this article out, you got to read this. Tell us what Earthworks Institute is.
We are a nonprofit environmental education, experiential education organization. We are based right here in the city, and most of our clients and organizations that we work with are also city-based. We direct our efforts towards youth and families that live in the city because we feel like there needs to be a greater effort to get these kids outside and exposed to nature and things that are, you know, healthy for them. And there seems to be a large lack of that here in Rochester, especially in city areas and urban areas.
Evan Lowenstein's here, and he wears a number of hats. But, Evan, this hour, what hat are you wearing? I guess you said sort of a community advocate. How would you want to describe it this hour here?
I would describe myself as a longtime community environmental and conservation advocate, but I also have a background in urban and environmental planning. So for years, I've also been involved in what we would call the smart growth movement or designing communities with the environment in mind, and have accrued an array of experience sort of sticking my nose into things, but also following my nose to a lot of different environmental issues and quests in the community.
That's great. And I do want to touch on this hour what we mean by smart growth, particularly because I think we had a stretch of design that was sort of cookie cutter and really disregarded nature in many ways for many years in this country. And then what the question becomes, how do you sort of either retrofit or regear communities towards smart growth, nature in mind, all these different things? So I'd like to get into that this hour if we could.
Sure.
Amy Jerry's here, a director and teacher at Wren's Nest Waldorf Preschool, which is where, Amy?
It's in my home in the Upper Monroe neighborhood.
Very good. And you've been doing that for how long?
I've had the program for a full 3 years.
Okay. How's it going?
It's going wonderfully. As far as I know, it's unique to the area and that we spend at least half of our morning outdoors.
I can't wait to talk to you, especially about, you know, I think what parents often confront when they think about kids and what's appropriate for kids, indoor, outdoor, getting sort of a mix of settings, how quickly technology comes into a child's life and how that might pull them away from nature. So we'll have plenty to talk about with you as well. And Jen Green is a PhD student in teaching and curriculum at the University of Rochester. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And for you, Jen, you know, when we hear nature deficit disorder, what does it mean to you?
I think it's pretty straightforward. It just means you're not spending enough time in nature to fulfill the needs that you have as a growing child. And I guess it expands also to being applicable to adults as well. I don't think it's exclusive to children. But I guess I want to expand also on my background that I'm contributing from my perspective today. Beyond being a PhD student at U of R in teaching and curriculum, I also teach the younger children in the forest school through Earthworks. And I've had an organic gardening business for 15 years now. And as well, I also homeschool my own children, which was deliberately a way that we were able to provide them with more access to the outdoors.
When you were thinking about homeschooling your own children, did you, for lack of a better term, did you sort of survey to try to, did you try to figure out what might be coming their way if they stayed in a traditional educational setting? How did you make that decision?
Well, it was pretty clear. It was not a hard decision at all for us. I substituted for a while in a local school district, and seeing the way that in a conventional school that the day is carved out with very little time for outdoor exploration, that was one of the primary decision-making factors, for sure.
We've talked about how recess has been curtailed in many places, mm-hmm. and even where it is not curtailed, it seems much more structured than it used to be. Is that just me, or do you think that that's true?
Well, I do think that it's true, and part of that depends on the environment that the children have access to. And so this is something that if we really want to support exploration in outdoor areas, that means going beyond just a concrete asphalt prefabricated playground area. It means actually being immersed in woodland areas and fields and prairies and grasses so that you can have contact with a real experience with nature. And there's been studies to support that the difference between having access to these more contrived play areas is not as supportive of fine and gross motor skills, social development, as well as cognitive development as well.
Mm-hmm. Lindsay, you and I are around the same age, and this is more than, I think more than a lot of different generational changes. This is a severe one when it comes to sort of day-to-day norms, when it comes to play, parental expectation. I mean, I am feeling a little bit like, you know, I don't want to be get off my lawn guy again, but I do think back to when you and I were growing up, and it's not just a cliche. Well, there was a creek in our backyard, and pretty much we would go try to catch crayfish and come back around dinner. And now I feel like my mother might be jailed for that. I mean, and this, sort of what you were expressing before the hour began. Tell me how you feel about that.
Well, let me explain to you how I grew up.
Yeah.
So I didn't even have a creek in my backyard. I grew up right off of Empire Boulevard. My backyard was the 590 Expressway, and my front yard was more or less McAvoy Park before the big do-over, before they turned it into a soccer field. So there was a lot of pavement around where I lived, but despite the fact that there was pavement, I managed to find forested areas, and I managed to travel, I think, a lot further than most parents would let their kids travel today, which involves going more than a block or two away. But you know, I made the quote-unquote journey, as it was, and my parents were very big on, okay, it's the weekend, see ya, and when you hear the whistle, come on back. And yeah, I fell and I got scraped, and I, you know, have broken bones here and there, and got dirty, and you know, discovered things in the forest and learned what it feels like to disappear and become camouflaged and play games and run wild. And I made that happen for myself, and I think that a part of that is because kids are inherently attracted to discovery and exploration, and that's a very primitive part of human beings. And I think that has disappeared quickly in a flash, in a blink of an eye overnight, as screens have come more to the forefront of entertainment and, you know, childhood attention. And I have nothing against screens. I mean, I am tied to my own phone just given the nature of what my job is. And I understand that screens can be very educational, and they can bring up information, you know, that is more relevant than anything we can read in a book, because it's visually stimulating as well. And that happens quickly. But I think a balance of screens and real hands-on visceral experience with the world is, you know, we are not so far evolved as a human species that we don't need that anymore growing up and developing.
Well, and I suspect just about every generation felt this way in some form or fashion, that kids were spending less time in nature than previous. It feels pretty extreme now. But I just want to ask you if you think the term nature deficit disorder is a real thing. You know, and I know you've read a lot about it. I've been doing a lot of reading about going back 10 years. NPR did a story in 2005 on it. But there are some academics who think, well, that's not really a real thing. That's an invented term that we use when we nostalgically feel like we are, the times are changing. Do you think it's a real thing?
Well, I do. And I think everybody has a point in their lives where they can say, well, back in my day when I used to travel to school and bare feet in the snow, you know, uphill both ways, blah, blah, blah. But I do think it's a real thing. And I can say that with confidence because my job involves, yes, being in the office. But I started Earthworks Institute because I loved being outside as much as possible with kids in the woods. So I do that for a job, for a living, and I see all different kinds of kids outside. I've worked with kids that don't know how to climb a tree at age 13. I've seen a little girl try to traverse a river, or not even a river, I shouldn't say that. Like for her, it was a river. It was a little stream, and she stopped and she looked at it, and she didn't understand that like there was another path forward except for to just walk straight through it. And she put 2 feet into the water with both of her shoes, soaking wet, and looked up at me like, okay, now what? And I literally had to say to her, okay, well, we can't go forward, so you have to take a couple steps back out of the creek. And then I just was able to show her, like, here, you can step on these rocks to keep your feet dry. And I'm not talking an infant. I'm talking, like, you know.
13-year-old, yeah.
Well, you know, it hurt. I think she was, like, you know, 8 or 9 or something like that. But yes, I do think nature deficit disorder is a real issue, and I think it needs to be addressed.
Evan, you're nodding. You think it's a real issue?
I do. I think my own experience, I was not the product of an outdoorsy family. I was pretty much self-taught. The good fortune for me is I lived in Steuben County. I grew up in Steuben County in a very traditional suburban subdivision. But it was in more of a rural area, and behind my house, there just happened to be a 2,500-acre wildlife management area, which to me, as a young child, was this amazing, endless wonderland. You know, I felt like Magellan, that exploring the uncharted parts of the world when I went out into that forest. And that's where I gained an interest in conservation and environmental education, but also a fear that that would be lost. Even at 9 years old, I was having recurring nightmares about waking up one day, going out the back door, and having all of that wildlife management area replaced with suburban housing tracts, which I think was my first interest in community planning and urban planning. But the real transforming experience for me was at age early 20s, I would say. I went to work at an outdoor education school in Eastern Shore of Maryland on the Chesapeake Bay. And what I experienced there was the transforming power of the outdoors. What we did is we hosted kids for anywhere from 1 to 5 days. They would come from public schools, private schools, from all over the Mid-Atlantic region, and they would have a truly immersive outdoor experience. All day, sleeping outdoors in tents, eating outdoors, on boats, in canoes, literally up to your neck in the swamp, ropes courses and things of that nature. And for me, seeing how the kids from Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Baltimore, urban children who had never had exposure to the outdoors before in any significant way. I had one teacher once say to me, these kids aren't afraid of hearing gunshots, but they are afraid of the dark because they don't know what the dark is. And the beauty of this was that the same teachers would later come to me at the end of the 3 days, 5 days, and say, you know, the kids that are such problems back home within the four walls of the school are not a problem here. And I don't know if that's because they're afraid to be here or whether they're flourishing or whether it's a little bit of both. And I said, it's probably a little bit of both. But to me, that experience was so profound that I dedicated myself to try to stay involved in environmental education and getting kids connected to nature, regardless of where I went in life.
That's definitely what Evan just said about not really being sort of used to the dark. That's another thing we're sort of losing. Is, I mean, it's out there. That's nice to know it's still there if you can go and find it. But obviously, with industrialism, we have more lights in a lot of places, but we've got lights in our hand with our phones. It's like we're afraid of just being sort of in a moment with nature in mostly darkness. And I think there's something really beautiful and serene about that, that maybe I'm getting too waxing and emotional about this, but that does seem to be kind of endangered.
I would say it is. I can't really tell the story of Echo Hill Outdoor School in Maryland without telling the tale quickly of a real inspiration. It's a tragic story, but it's also a happy story that one of the people who perished in the plane that hit the Pentagon on September 11th was a Washington, D.C. school teacher who would bring her kids to Echo Hill Outdoor School every year. She was on the school's board. That's the school where I worked as a teacher 20 years ago. And she felt so strongly about making sure every class in her inner city Washington, D.C. school would have this experience. She was completely dedicated to it. And of course, being an elementary school teacher, she already had a lot on her plate. But she raised the money. She served on the board of the school. And I feel obligated to continue her quest of getting kids, especially city kids, connected to nature. It's too bad that she is gone, but her story certainly has inspired me and a lot of other people.
Lindsay sent me an article from, where was it, Orion? It was in Orion. It's called The Nature Principle, and I'll make sure this afternoon I post it on my Twitter feed if you want to check it out. Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. And that's, Richard Louv, is this the name of Nature Deficit Disorder, Lindsay? Is that like sort of the, is this the godfather of the?
He is the godfather. He kind of wrote the Bible, so to speak.
Because I want to just read real briefly from this. Because as I said at the beginning of the hour, it's not just a conversation on, well, we should take more walks or we should go outside more. I think there are educational components, which our guests in different ways are talking about, raising kids from very early ages. And I think that there are community planning components. And I think what Louv writes here goes into all of that. And I think our guest can address that. He writes, reviewed by Hank Lentfer in Orion on The Nature Principle, Lentfer writes, in The Last Child in the Woods, Richard Louv warned that nature deficit disorder threatens our health, our spirit, our economy, and our future stewardship of the environment. Louv's newest book, The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder, takes the next step and tackles the ambitious task of mapping our way to a more connected future. And Louv writes the following, quote, the most vibrant cities will be those that integrate the population into an urban environment enriched by both natural and renatured habitat. And his optimism is rooted in the well-researched benefits of office buildings built around centralized greenhouses, neighborhoods studded with small parks, and yards sprouting spinach in place of grass. I think I'd like everybody to weigh in on that. I mean, my brain goes to so many different places, not the least of which is the Parcel 5 discussion in Rochester. What should you do there? Should it be one big office park? Should it be a performing arts center or a casino? Should it be mostly green space? I mean, these kind of conversations are everywhere. So let me go around the table, and I'll start with Evan because you mentioned smart growth. Mm-hmm. This seems like it's a conversation on smart growth or sort of reintegrating nature. Do you agree with that?
I do. I think
because he doesn't say smart growth right here, but it seems to be.
I think the challenge that urban planners are facing these days, and it's a welcome challenge certainly for me, is we do see that having more people living well in urban areas is the key to protecting the character and the ecology of suburban and rural environments and wilderness and reining in sprawl and having people living more efficiently in higher density. But the challenge inherent with that is how do we make these dense urbanized environments, places where people can still have meaningful interface with nature and avoid nature deficit disorder. And as planners, we think that's totally possible. Now, I would say a wilderness experience is an important thing for everybody to have as regularly as possible. But I'm sure that Lindsay can attest to this because sometimes the kids can't go to her into the forest. She has to go to the kids on the grounds of their school. And she understands and helps to share the fact that even an urban school campus, it has an ecology and a nature all of its own. And so wilderness experiences are transforming and important, but it's important for us to design working, functioning, accessible, real nature within the urbanized area. And I think that is a challenge that the planners of today and tomorrow have taken on and have deployed some amazing results.
You see anything locally you'd point to?
Well, I look at Rochester. I think one thing that people who are from Rochester underappreciate is the magnificence of our urban parks. When I lived in Virginia, which I did, I lived in Charlottesville, Virginia for 13 years before I moved here, and that place was very smug about how great of a amazing place it is to live and one of the greatest places in the country to live. And yeah, it's nice. But one thing I learned when I went from there to here is that the city of Charlottesville has virtually no sizable urban parks, whereas Rochester has these huge monumental parks with these with bona fide nature still intact. And that is such a gem for our community. And we should use them as much as we can. And so I think that just these aren't new things that we've done. These are 100-year-old things that we still are lucky to have in our community is these amazing nature parks right in the city.
Eventually, we'll appreciate Olmsted a little bit more.
I think so. But I think in other parts of the country, there are other cities that are, you know, decommissioning unneeded industrial areas and turning them into green spaces. I mean, there's so many innovative things going on right now, but they're meeting the dilemma, I wouldn't say a dilemma, but the challenge of creating livable, urbanized, high-density spaces that have real nature in them that everybody can access.
Okay, so there's a kind of a planning angle, and I see the phone ringing. Listeners, if you want to join the conversation on nature deficit disorder from any of these angles, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255. You can find me on Twitter at Evan Dawson. And yes, I'm talking about nature deficit disorder with the phone in my hand, but that's okay. As Lindsay said, it is part of work, and you try not to just let it overwhelm your job. Before I get to your calls, let me just kind of go around the room, though, and get different perspectives on the way we kind of, as a society, integrate with all of this. And Jen, I would just say you were nodding at several points there. Anything you want to weigh in on what you heard? Go ahead.
Well, I guess up to this point in the conversation, we've been providing kind of personal experiences or, mm-hmm. you know, anecdotal kind of perspectives. But I want to stress that really the benefits of being outdoors is really, there's an immense amount of research that supported this. And so the benefits are just very wide-ranging. They fall into cognitive, social, physical, spiritual areas. They've shown reduced symptoms of ADHD in children, increased language development, better impulse control, diverse imaginative and creative thinking, increased academic performance, higher attention spans, greater abilities to focus, is just all from the cognitive range. But in addition, from the social realm, the children typically have more positive feeling about each other, increased collaborative skills and interaction abilities. And then moving into physical, you know, I already commented on their motor skills, but also obviously this is a good way to combat childhood obesity. And there's even research out there that shows that there's a lower chance of children becoming nearsighted because if they don't have enough exposure to the light that's bright outside, then the growth of their eyes will not be of that it needs to be to have perfect vision. So really,
where's the downside, Jen?
Yeah, right. I'm waiting for the caller to come in. There's gotta be a caller.
Look,
right.
I joke, right. But all yeah. of what you're saying is it's not necessarily even just hypothesis anymore.
Right, there's and that's research. My point. There's real research.
So why
for decades,
are we
right.
still sort of moving a glacier a little slowly in terms of reintegrating with this?
Well, I think that the challenge arises is that we've become a society, and this is reflected in our schools and how they're run, that we're really trying to standardize things. So having room for open-ended learning and having space for children to make mistakes, to make their own decisions about things, is becoming, the emphasis is being decreased. And so when we're outside, and I think this is also an important point, that when we're talking about being outside, we're not talking about just being outside. We're talking about being outside in a way that children are allowed to make those mistakes and allowed to have freedom and to get muddy and to do these things. You can't go outside and be a helicopter parent and have the same effects. The potential isn't going to be reached to the same degree that it would be otherwise. I think outside time is good in any case, but really we have to let the kids be able to make their own decisions, have this sense of autonomy, having a sense of, and I mean, and this falls into some of the research that Dr. DC and Dr. Ryan over at the U of R have conducted in self-determination theory, which is founded on the idea that you can reach your maximized potential and ability to be engaged and have increased motivation to pursue your goals if you have a sense of autonomy, so you're making your decisions, you have a sense of connectedness, so you're having that social interaction with other people and collaborating, and then you also have a sense of competence, so you feel capable. So if you're given that space to be able to make risky decisions and work your way through them, then you build your self-confidence and your confidence.
The phones just went nuts, which is great. We're going to spend the second half hour on the phones. Just going to close a couple of loops here. I think, maybe I'm off base, but I think of something like restorative practices in school, restorative justice, which is an approach that, before it gained some currency, I think, like a lot of things, when you've got systems that rely on data, standardized tests, or analysis that's easy to see in numbers, sometimes you need more of that research to be able to go in and say, look, what we're talking about with nature deficit disorder, what we're talking about with access to nature and sort of breaking free of some of these strictures is not just a concept anymore. We have research that goes along with it. Isn't that going to make it easier to sell, to get more people on board to sort of break that status quo? You think?
There's a lot of things that are hard to sell, even though they're evidence-based.
Wet blanket. Oh. It's true. You're right, though. And status quo is sometimes easier.
It should.
I guess having research and having evidence, though, certainly doesn't hurt the argument. Gets you in maybe the door to open a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Amy, Jerry, what do you want to weigh in? Go and slide a little closer to the mic for me. Go ahead.
I want to weigh in with a very simple word, joy. I second everything Jen is saying about research. All you need to do is go outside with your child and see them playing in the mud, climbing a hill, climbing a log that's bigger than this room. And there is no question about how good this is for the development of the child.
I want to go do that right now. Forget just a child. And Lindsay, I think, again, to square up what it is that you do with Earthworks Institute, how do you grow your mission? You know, what's the process that you're undertaking now to get your work in front of more people and to create more partnerships?
It's a multi-pronged approach. We are sometimes contacted by schools or organizations who say to us, look, we just don't know how to do this. You know, we don't have the right kind of instructors, or people just have forgotten how to do that. And can you come in and just talk with us and maybe do a quick consulting seminar and give people some ideas? We can do that. Sometimes we have people who we meet, or I should say, you know, I meet, you know, socially, who say, oh, well, I run this really amazing after school program, and I would love to see or hear your ideas, or see you come in and run a day program with the kids. Occasionally, I'll just go out and I'll make a cold call introduction to somebody who runs an organization and introduce myself and tell them what I do. And I honestly have never had a single instance or occasion where somebody has told me, you know what, we don't think that that's important. It's always something that people say, oh, I didn't know that you existed, but I'm so glad that you're here because we need more of this. I get that from everybody all the time. We need more of this. So we offer programs to the community. So literally anybody in the public can just, you know, go on our website and say, hey, this is something that looks like it would be awesome to do. I want to go outside and I want to learn how to do friction fire. I want to learn how to track animals or what an edible or medicinal plant is. And we are happy to do that. But we also do consulting in schools. And then we actually run programs as a part of like an extended day program, or we're looking at a partnership with the Y. We also run programs for the Center for Youth. We're involved in GRASA, the Greater Rochester Association for Outdoor, or sorry, not for outdoor, for after school. I can't think of the full
activities.
Thank you. we have a lot of tie-ins, but everybody that we work with thinks that our work is valuable and unique and needed, and we're always happy to reach out and make more connections.
We got a lot of people on the phone who want to jump in with connections of their own. Chris, Lila, Nancy, Gloria, we're coming your way to the phones after this short break on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the next Connections, it's an annual tradition. Your chance to hear from dozens of local organizations that serve those in need, charities, all kinds of groups that are trying to raise funds, raise goods, put together gift drives for the holidays. They will be talking to you in quick succession, both hours. Your chance to hear what the community needs and, if you want, how you can help Wednesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Nature deficit disorder is what we're talking about this hour, and all the various prongs about how it impacts us and what to do about it. Let me start with Chris in South Bristol. Go ahead, Chris.
Well, thanks for taking my call. Just more of a question about a concept that we're down in South Bristol, and my school district is Naples. We're trying to figure out whether or not we see a lot of folks come and recreate in the hills here. We've got two ski resorts, that type of thing, mountain biking and hiking. Is there a term that you could fall, like, kids aren't in control of where they live, technically. It's where their parents are. So if they're to move to an area like South Bristol and then commute to work, say, in the city, is that a concept that everybody's trying to, promote, like a play where you stay as opposed to where you live? And I just wanted to advocate also for the Rock City Skate Park, because I think that is whatever you're talking about right now is really poignant, and I believe in it. But then we'd like to see a little more energy based on getting kids outside to skate with and multi-generational. But I'll take your response off the air to the concept of, people commuting to Rochester or the areas, urban areas, and living in the country or rural areas for recreation's sake.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Guys, what do you think here? You stumped some of us here. Evan Lowenstein, go ahead.
Assuming I understand your question correctly, certainly, the purest environmentalist ecological view would be that minimizing your commuting is probably the best for ecology. But we wouldn't necessarily fault someone for wanting to live in a suburban or rural community. That's a choice that we feel like everyone is entitled to. But as smart growth planners, which I subscribe to from training and experience, we want to make a strong case for living what we call a location-efficient life, which means if you can live in a more dense, urbanized area and minimize your carbon footprint with less commuting, but still have easy access to real wilderness or real natural areas, that to us is an ideal scenario. If you live in a rural area and you have access to real nature right literally at your doorstep or nearby, I think that's a wonderful thing. So I think I'm not sure I really interpreted the question properly, but if I did, I think that minimizing commuting is something important to those concerned about ecology and the climate change phenomenon. But I think that there's lots of ways you can experience nature and minimize your ecological footprint at the same time.
And I think maybe if I'm interpreting where he was going with this, Evan, I think there are different ways that you can work where you play where you work, not have to commute, and I think we're seeing, first of all, if we have these either re-engineered cities, if we have smart growth, you have more of an opportunity to live in a densely populated area but not feel like you're totally disconnected from a chance to be in any green space. Or if you live in a more rural space, we are becoming a little bit more adaptable as a society to be able to work where you live and to not have to commute. So I think there's probably different ways to do it, but smart growth, at the very least, does sound like it wants to keep sort of an ecological footprint and efficiency in mind. Fair, Evan?
Yeah. We talk a lot in the field about location efficiency being the piece that we're not as conscious about, but that is important to ecology. But I think that in this country, everybody should have the right and the ability to range a little bit to access the nature that's available to them.
Okay. Nancy in North Rose next up. Go ahead, Nancy.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just so excited to hear about this wonderful, rich, and vital topic today. I'm on a 20-acre holistic organic parcel out here in Wayne County, surrounded by monoculture, chemical-intensive agriculture. And I'm also excited at the possibility of perhaps partnering with some of your guests. I've got I'm working on establishing a not-for-profit here on this piece I'm calling Earth Eden Sanctuary, where I have taught young people as part of the woofing program, the willing workers on organic farms, about sustainable, holistic living here. And I want to bring, there's so many things that I could wax poetic on the different aspects of this topic, but my experience as a young mother, when I had my son who at that time was like 3 years old, and he would be, you know, cooped up indoors, and just his energy level was such that it seemed like the house couldn't contain it. He was just bouncing off the walls, and I would take him up to the lake in, you know, the woods and just cut him loose. And I immediately saw this transformation happen. I mean, he just calmed down and his whole countenance changed, and there was a smile and a brightness and a curiosity and an ease about him that was so clearly evident of the impact nature has on our entire psyche, our emotions. And I have also volunteered in schools in this area where kids, again, are very focused on the technologies and, you know, indoor activities, and there's so many issues that are being faced with attention deficit disorder, et cetera, where I feel so strongly that this could help them connect with something that's much, much larger, much more exciting and life-affirming, and that would inspire their curiosity. There's just so much to it. So I'm excited to hear about all that's going on in the Rochester area, and would also hope to be able to connect with bringing maybe some classes out to see how it might be done on a small parcel in a very holistic manner that includes, you know, a real diversity.
What was the acronym, Nancy? What was that acronym again?
It's EarthEdenSanctuary.org is the website.
And you said there was something with lots of W's, I thought.
Woofing. And Willing Workers on Organic Farms. It's a global program for anyone really who's interested in learning about organic farming, and it's an exchange labor for room and board.
Thanks for the phone call. You guys want to jump in on any of that there?
I'd like to comment on her word curiosity. Richard Louv talks about this. The difference of learning outside in a natural environment is that you're fully engrossed and using all of your senses. Technology really requires a visual and an auditory sense. And she brings in something about aliveness, and that came to me also about what it's like to be fully human and alive, and how that experience happens with technology versus how it happens outside in the natural world.
I thought of Louv as well, and we'll put Jen Green back on the spot here with an evidence-based question, because, you know, you had Nancy and North Rose sharing a really touching personal story. Louv himself writes about a personal story recalling the garden that from his boyhood home and the demise of that garden. He says his dad sort of went into depression, debilitating depression, and he thought at a young age that there's a danger with severing our contact with nature, with something that we love to do in the outside world. He saw that with his father. Nancy's describing a personal story. At some point, do we have enough of these personal stories piled up to feel like, you know, that's all the evidence we need to know about the personal impact, or should we be looking for something else as well to bolster the claims of the value of that connection with nature?
Well, I mean, as I described before, I mean, there's piles and piles of research to support this. It's a matter of, on a practical level, of how to implement it. So if we're not going to have the outdoor exploration focused on as much in schools, then it has to happen in homes. And that is a change in parental behaviors than what is typical in many families right now, which means cutting back on screen time and increasing outdoor time.
Well, I've got others who want to weigh in. Lindsay, you want to jump in there?
I just wanted to say that we are talking a lot about anecdotal evidence when it comes to people's experiences seeing children evolve and come alive and experience joy, but one of the other things that I know for sure that is not anecdotal and that the government is jumping in on, believe it or not, shocker, is the benefit of exposing veterans who have post-traumatic stress to outdoor experiences. And they call this wilderness therapy, but it can happen even on a less wildernessy level. You know, you don't have to take the vets outside and put them in a crazy survival setting because, you know, most veterans know how to survive. But just giving them that time and exposure to being outside, there's lots of real hard evidence that supports, people who have serious trauma being healed by the power of outdoor exposure and nature exposure. So that exists as well.
Evan?
I'm glad that you brought up the veterans. I read about that recently myself. And we talk a lot about children with nature deficit disorder, but reflecting on my own experience as a naturalist, and one of the most profound things was we could take fourth graders out on a boat and haul in some fish and look at them. And then we used to have some elder hostel programs that would come visit us who were 65 and over. And the reaction of a 74-year-old and a 4-year-old to catching and looking at those fish was not that much different. The sense of curiosity, the sort of affinity to the natural world is not just something that young people experience and need. And as people are living longer, getting older more and more, living in assisted living facilities and outliving their ability to drive or to function on their own, that curiosity and the benefits of that connection to nature is still there. And I think that as we think about nature deficit disorder, we have to think about all points on the life spectrum.
Okay, let me get back to your phone calls. And this is Lila in Rochester. Next up, go ahead, Lila.
Well, I'm so glad to come after Evan because it turns out that I am 82 years young. And when I was in the 70s, I was going back to school. And I used to bring in Brighton just earthworms and slugs and snails. Just you're talking about nature like it's some little faraway thing. But if we got children in the elementary schools to hold, even in kindergarten, to not to be repulsed and talk about that everything is food for everything else and how precious snails are. I'm in an assisted living facility, and I have two snails in my room right now. And my favorite dinner table conversation is telling people that snails are hermaphrodites. When they mate, they both fertilize each other, and they both lay eggs. And we can do that at anybody's place. You just take up a shovel full of soil and have a sense of wonder about ants. We're so busy spraying and killing everything that we forget that everything is food for birds and everything eats everything else. And there's been a balance in nature, as Rachel Carson so beautifully pointed out in her book Silent Spring. And the children used to love it when I'd come into school because they always knew I'd have some sexy thing, like something they never saw before. And then when I'd come the following week, they tell me that they saw it in their backyard, like they just come back from the moon.
Well, Lindsay Cray, you can relate to that, right? The way they react and they say, I had no idea.
It just warms my heart. I mean, she nail on the head. I mean, that is exactly, that's why we started Earthworks, is because just being able to allow kids to relate to something so small and so basic is such an incredible experience for them and for us as humans. You know, adults get to share that experience with children. I don't know how many listeners out there are familiar with Edward O. Wilson, E.O. Wilson. Mm-hmm. He introduced this hypothesis of biophilia, which suggests that there is an instinctive bond between human beings and other living systems. And he defines this as like the urge to affiliate with other forms of life. And kids are the greatest example of that, because we come into this world as like, you know, fresh and unadulterated and and new to everything, and we want to see and experience it all, and that's what makes us as humans whole. That's what, you know, that's what allows us to be alive, like just like you said, Amy. And giving kids that experience, allowing them to have that, is perpetuating that aliveness. So thank you so much for calling in and sharing in the
anecdote. Thank you, Lila. And by the way, Lindsay, was it E.O. Wilson, who might be around Lila's age, who just published a book on a prescription for, I think, setting aside half the land on this planet or something along those lines. Is that right?
That's a great question.
Okay, Kat Schwarz, the engineer behind the glass today, Robin, Kat, do a little homework for me, see if I'm crazy or if I'm right here. E.O. Wilson, I thought that name, that was a book that I wanted to get that I have not read yet. I think he's got a new book on a prescription for what to do with the remaining land on this planet. I think the idea is set aside half of it. Don't use it, but if I'm totally misrepresenting him, I'm going to apologize. Hopefully we'll find out before the end of the hour. Let me get Gloria in Canandaigua, who's been waiting. Go ahead, Gloria.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I love hearing the conversation that you're having, and it brought back incredible memories. I'm 71 years old, grew up in Rochester in the inner city, and at that point, at that time, we lived in a small apartment complex with family, and the yard that we had was very, very small, and there wasn't grass. It was dirt, and that's what we played with. And, we'd do things like make meatballs for our neighbor, Donna Maria. You know, we thought we could do that, and the only animals that we had were the little kittens from a mama cat that lived in a bar across the street, and we would take them, and by hand we would pick out so it was incredible. My parents were upward mobile, moved to Rundequoit area across from Seneca Park and the zoo. Opened up a whole new view of life. I got into trouble at a new home that did have grass because I wanted to play in the mud. And the neighbor friend of mine fell in the mud, and I got blamed terribly. and actually, I can tell you that then I got my bachelor's of fine arts degree in pottery, of course.
Ah, very good.
And taught college for kids, you know, and brought the kids to the lake so that they could dig up their own clay to bring home.
Well, Gloria, I've just got to jump in because we're going to lose the hour, and I want to try to squeeze in one more phone call. The good news is kids are still doing that if you let them. All my son wants to do is dig in the dirt pile if we let him. That was the whole summer. Can we play in the dirt pile?
And we want to make that opportunity too. Yeah,
absolutely. So there's a functional question from Laura in Clifton Springs on nature deficit disorder. So Laura, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'll try to make this quick. Speaking of playing in dirt piles and things, I'm a farm kid. I grew up covered in dirt, playing manure piles with my horses, everything. So my boyfriend grew up in a very, very clean household, exposed to no antigens. We're both in our mid-20s now. And I love going outside. And he wants to go outside with me and do all of these things, but he can't because he is literally allergic to everything. And there's no doubt that he has nature deficit disorder. And I was wondering, what are some things for people with nature deficit disorder and severe allergies, what can they do to increase their exposure to nature?
That's a great question. Thanks for that. Anyone want to try to attack that? It's a hard one because I'm not sure. We don't have an allergist in studio.
Right.
But Jen?
Well, if you could, I mean, just a simple thing to do is to bring some of the outdoors in. If you could figure out exactly what it is the allergies are about, there's ways that you can encourage the environment of your home to be more nature focused. So, you know, having sticks and branches and leaves and things like that, if you can just select those that you know that won't be cause reaction, then bring those into your home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little at a time.
Yeah.
Good luck. We learned from Dr. Shahzad Mustafa, a local allergist recently on this program, that there is a huge difference between kids who grow up in sort of these sterile environments versus kids who grow up in the dirt. And what's fascinating is kids can grow up on a farm, kids can grow up in the country or in the dirt, not really have any allergies at all, but within 18 months after moving away and sort of to more of the city, more of the sterile environment, they develop allergies. So our bodies dig being in the dirt, I think, is what kind of one of the points there. And by the way, Kat Schwarz, thank you very much for bailing me out. I was right, E.O. Wilson. So this is a book that I want to read. It's called Half Earth. It's his new book. And according to the Smithsonian, Wilson recently calculated that the only way humanity could stave off a mass extinction crisis as devastating as the one that killed the dinosaurs would be to set aside half the planet as permanently protected areas for the 10 million other species. And he wrote a book called Half Earth about it. I'll check it out and read it. Some quick final thoughts here. Lindsay Cray, you pulled this great group together. What do you want to leave the audience
with
today? That's
heavy, Evan. That's really heavy. I will just say this, that whether you're an adult or a child, it doesn't make a difference. Basically, if you spend more time being outside and understanding your environment and understanding your connection to the world, there's no doubt that it makes you a more whole person. And the more that you can understand your connection to the world, the more you realize that you wake up every day and you go outside, and this is not an abstract background out here, that this is the real world and that you are involved in it, and that everything has a utility, and that every one of those utilities is related to you as a life-sustaining source. And so make that time. Make that time for you and your kids and your friends, and just see how much it'll change you.
Earthworks Institute online? Are you online?
Online. We are a non-for-profit organization. We are online at www.earthworksinst.org.
Earthworks
Inst. Short for Institute.
I-N-S-T.
.org.
The executive director is Lindsay Cray. Thank you for bringing this to our attention and for being here. Thank you so much, Lindsay. Our thanks to Evan Lowenstein as well. Thank you. Great seeing you. Thanks for being here. Our thanks to Amy Jerry, director and teacher at Wren's Nest Waldorf Preschool. Thank you for being here, Amy. It's been great having you. And Jen Green, who wears lots of hats in our community. Thank you. Thanks for being here as well, Jen. Our thanks to Rob Braden and Kat Schwarz and everyone who called in these 2 hours today. Got as many of you could. Thank you so much for interacting with the program. I'm Evan Dawson, and we'll talk to you Wednesday.